Tawanda Six, a Black arts and culture program of the Black Sisters Art, a culture program of the Black Sisters, got my spill. I'm so into Victoria Theodore is Grateful. Black Women's Media Project. And again, that was Victoria Theodore Grateful. And we're going to start our program this evening, Wednesday evening, with a rebroadcast of an interview, pre-recorded interview with director, Academy Award-winning director Roger Ross Williams. His film, God Loves Uganda, is having a theatrical opening release at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco Friday, November 1st. And the director is actually going to be in town, so you can actually go meet him, and he's going to be engaging the audience in conversation probably before and after the film. And God Loves Uganda is a film that will really move you to action. The Academy Award-winning filmmaker Roger Ross Williams is exploring the role of the American evangelical movement in fueling Uganda's terrifying turn towards proposed death penalty for homosexuality. And you might know the director from his Academy Award-winning film, Music by Prudence, which was looked at another story of wonderful musician in Zimbabwe who is disabled, and he looks at her music and how the art is what frees and liberates her. And this particular film is looking at another community that is sort of below the radar and not well represented in a lot of different communities, including our own here in America. And this particular film looks at the use of biblical law and the proposed biblical law to criminalize the homosexual or gay and lesbian community in Uganda, and the American push and leading role in this particular intolerance. So I'm going to play this interview, and then I'm going to rebroadcast another program from last year where we looked at James Baldwin's visit to Bayview Hunters Point, and another film that was developed from that visit recently that looked at the young people that James Baldwin spoke to. Maybe 30, 40 years ago today, and to see what they were doing around social change in their communities. And we end that particular rebroadcast with an interview with directors and one of the principals in a film that Roger Ross Williams looked at, and is actually one of the gay rights activists in Uganda, David Kato. He was actually killed, and this particular film looks at his life. It's called They Call Me Kuchi, and that's a name that they use in Uganda for the gay and lesbian community. And so we start and end on the same theme. So enjoy. Yeah, you're opening in San Francisco, and I'm so happy that you're having a theatrical release, because this film is one that everyone needs to see. I mean, you know, this is like, wow, the colonial march continues, right?
Absolutely. It continues, and no one is really sort of, you know, paying attention to this issue. Sub-Saharan Africa, they're very vulnerable population, you know, because of, you know, poverty and HIV and AIDS. And, you know, they're sort of ripe for the picking. And the American fundamentalist conservatives have gone in there, and they have, they found, like, you know, sort of, you know, an easy target, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Because I saw another film about the HIV/AIDS activist in Uganda who had been killed before I saw your film, so I knew exactly, you know, what you were talking about. But I just found it really interesting, sort of the end of your director's statement. I just want to just share that with the listening and reading audience, that you you write, in the well-known trope about Africa, a white man journeys into the heart of darkness and finds the mystery of Africa and its unknowable otherness. I, a black man, made that journey and found America. I'm like, wow, you're such a good writer, too.
Thank you. When you get on the plane to go to Uganda, the mm-hmm. amazing thing about it is that it is full with American missionaries.
Mm.
It's the number one destination of American missionaries. And they go there because it is a utopia. They go there because they have free reign. They can go into, as they told me many times, they can go into schools and homes and they won't have doors slammed in their face and people welcome them. And that's because they, they planned this sort of takeover of Uganda after the fall of Idi Amin, who outlawed evangelical Christianity and was a Muslim. And when he fell, Mike Bickle, the leader of the International House of Prayer, which is an organization that's featured in my film,
mm-hmm.
he was on the ground the day Idi Amin fell, as he said, bullets flying over his head with a group of American conservatives there to take that country as a Christian nation.
Mm. Yeah. And I was just the subjects, that you interview, Lou Engle, the evangelical Christian right, Reverend Joanna Watson, who is a closeted lesbian.
Yes.
Jonah Hall, I mean, like, wow. He's the director of media at the International House of Prayer and director of the International House of Prayer's Forerunner Media Institute. And then you go into this place, the International House of Prayer. You take us there and we can actually experience, the fervor of the membership and the preachers, et cetera. And then Reverend Kabia Kaoma?
Kaoma,
Anglican priest in his home nation of Zambia. And, it's really wonderful, hearing from him, who's in exile. And then the other bishop, Christopher Sinyonjo, and he's still there, and how brave he is,
he still lives there. He's been here with us for our theatrical release. It's been amazing having him.
Are you serious? He's been coming. He's been touring. Is he going to be in San Francisco?
No, unfortunately, he has to go back to Uganda because he has to attend another the World Council of Churches meeting in Korea. But it's always amazing to have him in the theater to directly interact with the audience, and it's so powerful for the audience. He's an amazingly brave man who stood up for LGBT equality, and
mm-hmm.
he's one of the only, if not the only, faith leaders in Uganda who have done that. And for that, he's been, horribly persecuted by his own church. But he refuses to back down because he really believes this is what God wanted, and that he's protected, even though there have been so many threats against his life. He believes that God is protecting him because God wants him to stand up for the rights. He believes that's what the Bible is, love. And he's an amazing, amazing man at 82 to be, fighting this fight.
Mm-hmm. There's so many villains,
Yeah.
I mean, goodness gracious, so many villains.
There's so many villains. It's great to have some heroes, and it's tough being at IHOP. IHOP is a powerful youth church with
mm-hmm.
1,000 full-time employees and a $30 million a year operating budget, and they target young people because they're vulnerable. Mike Bickle said to me, he's like, they have a that's why they their emphasis is on Christian rock,
mm-hmm.
and they have in their global prayer room, which runs, they have like Christian rock music, live music, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That and they haven't stopped playing for 13 years.
Mm.
So it is a and it draws you in. And he goes, the music draws in young people, and that's how we're able to draw in all these young people.
Mm-hmm.
But these young people then become the army that they then use to send the message around the world, because it's a missions base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so true. You know, Jesse and you know, Rachel Diggs, and then, you know, who are former students of the International House of Prayer Bible School, and they live there, right?
They live there full-time.
Mm-hmm.
They have an adopted Ugandan
mm-hmm.
Daughter,
mm-hmm.
and they really, you know, strongly believe in their mission. And, I, you know, when Jesse saw the film, you know, he's very defensive. It's hard not to be. It's probably very hard for him to watch. But one of the things that gave me hope is that he
mm-hmm.
said it made him more compassionate to homosexuals
mm-hmm.
after watching the film.
Nice.
You know, and that's a beginning. You
mm-hmm.
know, he didn't want to take responsibility. He said, all I'm doing is preaching the truth of the Bible, what he believes is the truth, that marriage between a man and a woman. And I said, but you have to understand that when you, as a white American who represents so much to Ugandans, you represent power and wealth and money, when you come into a country and you say you are going to go to hell if you don't follow, you know, our interpretation of the Bible, people listen to you because of what America represents. And you come in there with your money and your power and your influence as white Americans, and you wreak havoc and sometimes unknowingly, but it's you know, and that's what it is. I'm just trying to get them to like take a step back and say, wait a minute, this is. And when he saw that film and he saw the craziness, he's like, oh, okay, but you know. It's hard to get them to take responsibility.
mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking about when I saw the film earlier this year, and I was making reservations to travel to East Africa myself. I went to Ethiopia, and I didn't have lodging there. I knew where I was going to stay in Tanzania and Zanzibar and Zimbabwe, but I didn't have Ethiopia secure. So I was looking around, and I found this organization, I think it's Bethany House, and they have a guest house in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, and the money goes to some projects, but it's sponsored by missionaries, and because of seeing your film, I was like immediately, oh, are these those people too? You know, because there are a lot of missionaries in Ethiopia as well.
Yes.
And I was just checking, it's just sort of like, okay, are they a part of the International House of Prayer? You know, like I was doing all this.
Yeah, there, I mean, it's not the International House of Prayer is just one of many
mm-hmm.
many churches who.
Mm-hmm.
Who are, you know, preaching this sort of message of intolerance, and their very narrow biblical view,
mm-hmm.
and they're one of many churches working throughout sub-Saharan Africa. I've focused on them as an example, but
mm-hmm.
it's a widespread phenomenon that is, you know, causing a great deal of damage on the continent.
Mm, yeah, and so I didn't find those connections. However, I found, as a person that's not a missionary, I was basically sort of ignored in the guest house. I mean, the missionaries, you know, they got a chance, they got invited into people's homes, and they got a chance to, I mean, because it's a great, great program that the funds from the guest house support. I mean, there are a lot of children that have HIV and AIDS and don't have family, and there are a lot of street children, and they have a place to stay. However, I just sort of felt you know, it's really estranged as an African American in Africa, in Ethiopia, that I wasn't necessarily embraced because I wasn't Christian, because I was Muslim, and I was like, wow, well, you know, back home, you know, we fellowship with one another. You know, we find places where we can agree, because we agree on mostly everything. And I just thought the intolerance was so interesting. And then, you know, your background, you know, you're like, you've come from Africa and America. You're a Gullah person.
Yeah.
And you know, and you're kind of an expert because you grew up in the Black church, because your father is a religious leader. So you weren't coming to this as a novice. I mean, you know the scripture. You know the Bible. You know Christianity.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. You know, my whole family, I come from a family of ministers. You know, I grew up singing in the gospel choir of my family church from my whole life, and so I definitely know, and what is a shame is that in Africa the progressive church does not have a voice or the same voice as the fundamentalist conservative church, and that's a shame. And one of the call to actions is to get progressive, and especially, and even to get African Americans, you know, to go to Africa and take an interest and talk to Africa, so that there is another sort of voice coming from America. It's not just from, you know, this fundamentalist.
Yeah, definitely. Because I was just, how did you find out about this story? Because this is not your first time in Africa. Your award-winning film, and congratulations on being the first African-American to receive an Academy Award for film and music by Prudence. And I thought that was so cool because I wish I would have known music by Prudence and the band, because I was in Zimbabwe also this summer. Yeah, and I was like, oh, I could have looked them up, darn.
Yeah, amazing. They're so amazing, and they're still in Bulawayo in Zimbabwe performing. I was definitely not a stranger, but I did notice while making music by Prudence of the, you know, sort of hold that sort of fundamentalist had on the continent and in Zimbabwe. And that's what sort of sparked the beginnings of this, the idea to make this film. I was like, and I noticed that the prosperity gospel was huge, and that religion was, you know, big business in Africa, the business of religion, and that pastors were, you know, it was, you know, not the, you know, the same way, you know, you see that in America, you know, the old, I always think back to, like, my childhood and Reverend Ike, you know.
Oh, yes.
And who were like, you know, they were about, follow me and you will become wealthy, and that is and that message goes over very well to a vulnerable population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is so true. And then when you have, you know, leaders like, you know, Pastor Robert Kayanja, you know, who, you know, you see the trappings of success, you know, and his, you know, his Miracle Center Cathedral in Kampala, you know, you write that he's one of the top five wealthiest people in Uganda, and Uganda is one of the poor of African countries, African nations.
Yes, Uganda is, you know, but yeah, Uganda's, you know, it is, you know, there are a lot of poor countries in Africa, and Uganda's a huge country of 35 million people, and and now Uganda is, you know, they just found a huge oil reserve in, in Uganda. So there are some very, very wealthy, you know, there's just the great divide, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's the extreme wealth, and I mean extreme wealth, you know, with, you know, private jets and incredible homes, and then, you know, mostly everyone else is, you know, struggling for just a meal a day.
Yeah. So how do you get people like Pastor Kayanja and Pastor Martin Simpa, who was supporting the death penalty? Like, if you were found, in quotation marks, guilty of, you know, homosexuality, that you would you know, be killed. I mean, that would be capital crime. And then Pastor Scott Lively, you know, an American author who was just like a hate speech proponent. I'm like, oh my God, like, how can you do this? I mean, in America you can't do this, but you take this, take this stuff to other nations, and the free speech, which is free hate speech, you know, just, it's just, wow. It was just amazing, you know, what you shared of his character, you know, in your film.
Yeah, well, you know, this is why Scott Lively is being sued in U.S. federal court in Springfield, Massachusetts, for crimes against humanity. And this is why a federal judge just ruled that he must stand trial for crimes against humanity. And that's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
You know, yes, you can, but you can't. You know, he thought he got away with going to a country and preaching hate and convincing people to create this law. And he ends up being sued right there in his own backyard in Springfield, Massachusetts. You know, it's you know, I think the reason I got people like, you know, Robert Kyanja to participate and talk to me is because they believe that they believe they have God-given powers, and they believe in what they're doing. And you know, when I went to Kyanja, he said, "Oh, I knew you were coming. God sent you." And he goes, I think it's because I won the Oscar, he thought, okay, well, now you're going to make an Oscar-winning film about me.
Mm. Oh, my. Wow.
Yeah, ego.
Definitely. Like, what about the content?
Yeah.
Do you want to be known this way?
Hmm. Well, you know, I don't think that anyone sees that, you know, they're doing. I think that he's so huge. He's like, he's just one of the most powerful pastors in all of East Africa. And, you know, and he's not a proponent. You know, what Kyanja is the prosperity gospel, and Kyanja is just, you know, really connected to a lot of powerful pastors in America. Kyanja's not necessarily for the bill, unlike Martin Semper, who very much is at the forefront. He is the person who is the most outspoken, who throws huge mega rallies and marches upon the parliament to pass the bill. He took a million signatures to parliament to pass the bill now.
Mm-hmm.
He paraded ex-gays, as he's called them, to testify before the parliament, although one of those ex-gays later said he was paid by Martin Semper to say he was an ex-gay, but he was actually, he's like, I was born gay and I'll always be gay. And the New York Times famously interviewed him later that day in a hotel room where he said, oh, I was paid $35 to do that testimony before Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because people are desperate, and Martin Semper exploits that because he's trying to please his American benefactors and funders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Martin Semper lives in Las Vegas. You know, he's married to a white American missionary. They spend most of their time, you know, back in America, and he was on the payroll of many mega churches. And his abstinence work and his work against homosexuality pleases his American benefactors until he went too far. But it pleases them because they're frustrated here, because they're losing the battle in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So what are your hopes for the film here, and you know, in its you know, debuts here across the country?
I hope that people flood the theaters. People of faith, you know, especially go to the theaters. But I hope that everyone goes to the theaters. And I hope that people, this story and this understanding gets out there, so that we cut off the flow of money to places, to pastors like Martin Semper and many others in Uganda who teach intolerance and hatred. And, you know, it's about getting the word out and getting the story out. And we have a campaign with allout.org to keep hate off the collection plate, and actions you can take. So it's really about, you know, getting the film out there as best we can.
Mm-hmm.
those people like you that help us do that.
Yeah, super. And at the screenings, do you have like information for people to be able to, this is like a call to action kind of film?
Yes, we have a call to action card we hand out. You can
take
at screenings to get involved and, and help out.
Yeah. Okay. So as an out director, how has it been for you, to be out and having, a Christian religious background? And I hear that at the at the Academy Awards ceremony, and your mother was there, so it sounds like you can go back home. So, yeah, how has it been for you to walk, this walk as a gay black man, and being, you're really, sort of a high profile. I mean, you're in film and television. You're also a writer. You're not hidden at all.
Yeah. I think that, it wasn't easy, after I won the Academy Award, suddenly my community where I grew up, welcomed me back home, and they were proud, and then all of a sudden the part about being openly gay, took a back seat to them being proud of my accomplishments, just as an African American man who had done well, and I went back to my hometown to a huge parade, and I addressed my high school, and I addressed the local chapter. I was a keynote speaker, local chapter of the NAACP, and it was it's great to be who you are and show that my community that my sexuality doesn't make a difference. I think it helps open their minds and open the minds of the black communities have been traditionally very homophobic, and it's important to me to be an example as an out gay man for the black community, for young people of color who are gay and who, I've tried to be, I can't ignore the fact that I have to be a role model for them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Wow. So this film is sort of brought you full circle, huh?
It has. It has brought me full circle, and that's been really great. And that's why, you have to be passionate about films, and that's why I do what I do. I do it because I love telling stories, but also it's like I want to confront things that are really personal to me and go to places that make me uncomfortable, because that's where you're going to, create the best and greatest art, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you made the film Music by Prudence, why did you want to tell that story of the disabled woman? I mean, it's just so fascinating and so wonderful.
I think I wanted to tell that story because it was, a story of someone who was rejected by her community.
Mm.
Notice the theme here?
Yeah, totally. I was looking for that, yeah.
Prudence was someone who, a woman of great talent and intelligence who had been rejected by her community just simply because of the way she looked, because she had a disability, And she overcame that through her art and through her self-expression. And I think that story, obviously really spoke to me. And I think it spoke to a lot of people, which is, so it was, it's a very inspiring story. And she's an inspiring person. So, yeah. It was a natural for me to want to tell that story. So.
Right, yeah. And currently you're working on a feature narrative about the African-American Baptist Church entitled Black Sheep.
For me, I want to go and I want to, I've always, been interested in narrative filmmaking,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I want to sort of take the work I've been doing in documentary and really work with that in a different, you know, in a different sort of, you know, type of genre in narrative film, and that's very, very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When I think of killer black sheep, I think of killer of sheep.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Ah, interesting.
Great.
Yeah. So one last question. I just think it's really cool that you know, you're, you know, from the Georgia Sea Islands, you know, the Gullah Geechee culture, and I was just wondering, when you went to Africa, let's say for the first time, it was almost, I would think, from what I hear and what I know of the Gullah Geechee community, that, you know, there are certain Africanisms that are present within the culture, besides having a language, you know, that's unique and it, you can trace it back to the continent. There are certain, you know, religious practices, spiritual practices, you know, burial rites. I mean, you know, you name it, and it's a real African community, similar to the Maroon societies outside of, you know, United States, like in Jamaica and other places. And I was just wondering, sort of reflecting on that, and, you know, the kind of stories that you want to tell, and the kind of person you are, you know, sort of, you know, the ancestors that are living, speaking through you, you know, as a director, as an artist. We wanted to talk a little bit about that, you know, sort of what you carry within your DNA.
Oh, yeah, I think, you know, I think from my grandmother and my family, I definitely picked up a strong tradition of storytelling,
mm-hmm.
which is a strong African and strong Gullah tradition, and I grew up on, you know, my family's either sort of tobacco farm in South Carolina, you know, listening to stories from my grandparents, and I think that is something that I, you know, have definitely brought with me. And I think, you know, what's amazing was when I go to Africa, and I just finished the tour of the continent, and with this film, and the connection and the things from every little thing, from the food to everything, is so strong. I'm like, wow, you know, it's amazing how much we've kept. You know, you think that, you know, we have, you know, spent so many hundreds of years apart from the continent, and that, you know, but there is inside of us so much that we've held on to, and for me, it was that strong storytelling tradition, which has always been a part of my family and has always been a part of me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you had your ancestry traced for your family? Like, do you know where, you know, your line goes back to the continent? Do you know specifically where you're from?
I don't. I've always wanted to do that, and I never have gotten around to doing that yet. Mm-hmm. But I really, you know, that's something. It's on my bucket list to do.
Yeah, right now, I mentioned that because right now I'm sending my squabs into African Ancestry to .com to see for the matrilineal line. I've got to get my brother to do the patrilineal line to see sort of specifically where our family's from in Africa. So I'm really excited about that. So I'll know early December. but I highly recommend AfricanAncestry.com because it's a really wonderful program they've got. And last night I went to an event in Oakland, California, and there were these families that had their ancestry traced, and so the sister who is like the marketing person at the organization, she brought the packages, and so one at a time the families came up and they were told, oh, you know, this is your ethnic group and this is where your people are from, and they were just so excited, like eight families. It was just so exciting to be witness to that. And then others sitting in the room had had their ancestry done, and they were talking about the process and who they were and some synchronicity around, like, not knowing but knowing, because they were making some choices based on the DNA that they hadn't even been aware of, like, you know, some being inclined to want to learn Spanish and not knowing that on their father's side, you know, their ancestry goes back to Spain.
Wow.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. And two, a couple, they're both Yoruba, but didn't even know it. And then the outfit that the husband chose to get married in, he traced it back, and he saw those designs as indigenous to the ethnic group that he was a part of. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, yeah, I just want to just suggest that you know, put it number one or two on your bucket list.
Yeah, I will. I absolutely will do that.
Yeah, because I was just thinking that you never know. Maybe your people are from East Africa. Maybe that's why you've been drawn there.
Yeah, could be.
Mm-hmm.
I
possibly. You never know.
Yes, I definitely that.
Yeah, but congratulations again on such a wonderful film, God Loves Uganda. And God does love Uganda, you know?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, and congratulations on all of your wonderful work, and good luck on Black Sheep, and looking forward to, are you coming to town on November 1st?
I am.
You are? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I'll be there. I'll be doing Q&As at the screening.
At the Roxy? Oh, cool. And then there's something, I don't know, to be announced in the East Bay. Oh, that's so great. Oh, I'm going to have to be in the house.
Wanda?
Yes.
Wanda, sorry to interrupt, but we're going to have to have you wrap up in a few minutes, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, we were wrapping up, actually.
Okay, perfect. All right, no problem.
So, yeah, so hopefully I'll see you at the theater.
Yeah, love
bring
to
all
meet
your,
you.
Spread the word. Get mm-hmm. lots of people there.
We'll have to do a theater party. Come meet you.
Get the word out.
Okay, certainly. All right, you take good care.
You too.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. So that was director Roger Ross Williams speaking about his current film, God Loves Uganda, which is opening at the Roxy Theater Center in San Francisco on Valencia Street on Friday, November 1st. So definitely want to be in the house to catch him. That's going to be really wonderful. And when I mentioned the film Killer of Sheep, I failed to mention the director, Charles Burnett. He is the director of that classic film with, I believe, yeah, actually, yeah, I am correct. Abby Lincoln is playing a starring role in that film about a man who works in a slaughterhouse in Chicago, South Side. So now we're going to play this next rebroadcast of a program that was really wonderful. And as I mentioned, I'm going to have to play the whole program, which means that Call Me Choo Choo. It's actually Coochoo. Call Me Coochoo is the last part of this interview. I mean, of this show. So definitely stay tuned, because it's well worth your time, and great story. Both interviews are really fabulous. So without further ado, let me play this interview. Uh-oh. Let's see. Always. The interview ends, and then there's this space where do I fill it with conversation, or do I just have silence? But, of course, we can't be silent because there are no visuals, so I have to fill it with words. So I am looking for the interview, and I want to congratulate Alex and Harriet Bagwell on their Friends of the Negro Spirituals Heritage Award that they received the week before last in the annual event that gives awards, Friends of the Negro Spirituals gives awards to people that are keepers of the culture. And Alex and Harriet Bagwell, currently members of Ukanemawetu, are certainly keepers of the culture, and Alex in particular is a person who is an expert in Paul Robeson's heritage and work. And both of them are really beautiful singers. And I saw them more recently at the convocation, the 18th annual convocation at the 86th anniversary of the Church for the Fellowship of All People, Howard Thurman Church in San Francisco. And I need to stop talking because, oh, I found it. So looking forward to another conversation with you on Friday, All Saints Day, or Dia de los Muertos, and Happy Halloween, Happy Ancestor Days, and I'm so into the ancestors. This is, tomorrow is the conclusion of Ma'afa Commemoration Month in the San Francisco Bay Area, so make sure that you light a candle for the ancestors and remember them always, not just during October and not just on October 31st or November 1st, depending on sort of your November 1st or actually November 2nd, too. Peace and blessings. Here is the interview.
San Francisco? Yeah. Oh, man, I'm going to tell you about San Francisco. San Francisco ain't did me. I mean, ever since I got out of high school, I had a couple of jobs. I worked at a couple of hat companies and warehouses. I mean, after a while, they say, I guess we're going to lay you off for a couple of weeks, you know. All right, they talk about the South. The South is not half as bad as San Francisco. You want me to tell you about San Francisco?
Yes,
I'll tell you about San Francisco. The white man, he's not taking advantage of you out in public like they're doing down in Birmingham, but he's killing you with that pencil and paper, brother. When you go to look for a job, can you get a job? Can you get a job, Winkle?
This is San Francisco. Americans pretend does not exist. They think I'm making it up.
National Educational Television presents Take This Hammer.
Take This Hammer.
This is a film report on a visit to the city of San Francisco by the novelist, essayist, and playwright James Baldwin. Mr. Baldwin's guide on this tour of the city is the executive director of Youth for Service, Orville Luster.
Take This Hammer. You tell him I'm gone. You tell him I'm gone.
The drive from the airport into any American city looks pretty much the same. You could be anywhere. But for James Baldwin, this similarity goes deeper. On the drive into San Francisco, Baldwin began talking about the increasing bitterness, demoralization, and despair of Negro youths in northern cities. And it was decided that we would explore the existence of such attitudes and conditions in the city of San Francisco, with its widely advertised liberal and cosmopolitan traditions. Baldwin also talked about his concept of dues paying, or living up to one's responsibilities, and commented that many northerners seem to feel that because they do not live in Mississippi, they are somehow paying their dues.
I think the truth is that everyone, on the one hand, is fundamentally capable of paying his dues. But no one pays his dues willingly. You know. And the white man, like the black man, like any other man on earth, can pay his dues if he realizes that that's what he's got to do. As long as you think there's some way to get through life without paying your dues, you're going to be bankrupt. Because the bill has come in. It's not coming in. It is in. And the great question now is precisely what we've got in the bank. This, of course, is everything we think we have. Everything. And Birmingham is an incident, you know, which may become a shrine. What is really crucial is whether or not the country, the people in the country...
End of message. To delete this message, press 7. To save it in the archive.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, this is famous.
Hi. well, that was, we're here talking about historic visit of James Baldwin to Bayview Hunters Point about 50 years ago, and we are joined in the studio by Mr. Oscar James and also this famous
Bell.
Yeah, or Jackie Bell. And we heard your voice, I believe, early on in the broadcast. And today, Caroline Benz directed a follow-up conversation to this historic moment, and wanted us to maybe go around in our conversation and talk about sort of how you happen to be, you know, a part of this conversation with James Baldwin. And why don't we start with you, Mr. Oscar James.
Yes. I think it would be better to start with Mr. Bell. He was the one who spoke it first.
Oh, okay. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Bell.
Jackie, you on the phone?
Yes,
okay,
I'm here.
Yeah. Long time no see.
Hey, nice to hear and talk to you again, Oscar. Okay.
James Walker here.
All right. In 1963, we was roaming the hills, I call it, you know, and someone said there's a famous playwright, author, and historian on the hill, and he would like to talk to some of the youth and the grown adults on this hill and get their view of San Francisco and their living conditions and things like that. And so I went up on the hill and I approached him and I had a conversation with him before the film started, and he was telling me some very interesting things about, he was from New York and he was interested in finding out about San Francisco. So my view at that time, and still is that there was covert racism in San Francisco. And when I say covert, it's with paper and pencil, but also not getting an opportunity. And it was not by accident, but by design. And this was accomplished by limiting your exposure to classes in school that would bring you up. They would give you shop classes, clothing classes, food classes, and typing classes, and which you should have been getting business classes and classes that would steer you toward the upper echelon of society, like management. And this is what I mean by covert. And we needed role models at that time. And Mr. Baldwin was definitely a role model. So I hung on every word that he told me. And you might want to interject on that, Oscar.
Okay, I'm gonna come up to the present on the racism that still exists.
Okay.
We all know that it's a blind racism that's directed to the black community. We've since that time we've came a long ways in creating opportunities for our young brothers and sisters in the community. From having in 1970 started a memorandum of understanding to guarantee 50% of all employment went to the residents of Bayview Hunters Point and 100% citywide. But in the last year, that has been diluted to 25% San Francisco residents, which excludes blacks in our community in guaranteeing jobs for them. We just had a fire up here because they're doing a lot of construction now, and people are coming out of our community, coming into our community working, and the people who live in those housing projects and live in the surrounding areas, the blacks are not getting any work. So the racism still exists, even though we have came up in the 70s with the memorandum of understanding, the guarantees that the 50% of community residents get jobs and 35% gets contracts. I mean, during this time, from the 70s on up until the present time, we have gotten a lot of minorities, contracts, also the working thing. But with this new administration, that has came in now, we are not getting this. They're filtering other people into our community to buy out the blacks. In the 60s, we were 68% home ownerships in the Bayview Hunters Point community. The largest home ownership in the whole San Francisco Bay Area was blacks that was owning property in the Bayview Hunters Point community. Now it has dwindled down to less than 40%. And people are coming in now still buying and taking away from our community. We have came up with the college track to train our kids in our community to prepare them for college. We have a $3.5 million bond capacity that myself personally has been fighting Lenore in getting, and they have put the $3.5 million up for scholarships. But our problem is now educating our young brothers and sisters to be prepared to go to college. Our school system is fighting people's in Baby Hunters Point. They're putting teachers who are not qualified to teach, who don't want to teach. They don't have black history in our schools, in our community, which would make our young people want to go to school because they're learning about themselves and not about Paul Revere or someone like that where they're not interested. So they fall out of school. They don't learn anything about algebra, trig, or any of those things that would prepare them to become engineers. We have an opportunity now for the electrical trade is opening up in our community now where the people have to take algebra. It's not that many people in our community have learned algebra or trig. So what they're saying, they're going to have the test, but our people are not going to be able to take the test because from junior high school up to high school, they're not there. They're not being taught if they are there. You know, and it's designed for the black man in our community to fail. With our memorandum of understanding, it's open for everyone. In our community, we've always been over 60% black. But those are not the ones who are getting the benefits.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
so we're talking
goes back
about,
to,
right, yeah. Oh, go ahead. I just wanted to let our audience,
go ahead.
We're talking about the James Baldwin film.
May I interject something?
Hammer. And the film was documents James Baldwin's visit to San Francisco, specifically a conversation he had with young people and others in Bayview Hunters Point. And filmmaker Carolyn Benz has created a new film, which is like it's sort of a follow-up and also a new conversation, James Baldwin in San Francisco, Hunters Point Then and Now. And the film is going to be screening this evening with some of our guests at the Luggage Store Gallery at the screening in San Francisco this evening at 7:30. It's a free event, and afterwards there's going to be a great discussion. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I would like, this is James Slotin, one of the things that I would like to reiterate is that the same thing that propelled us to respond to the racism the way we did in the 60s and 70s, it's still going on right now, 50 years later, 49 years later, it's still the same thing. The fire in Hunters Point, I did some checking into it, and the same racism that caused us to stop Chet Atkins and Cahill from working back in the 60s and 70s, Oscar, Jackie, y'all remember that? When they first we stopped them. Well, it's the same thing that's going on now, and it's the same methods. The people in Hunters Point that's working and living up on West Point and Middle Point. And I've talked to some people up there, and I'm going up there today to look at the fire and talk to some people who are part of that community group. They've hired people from outside of Hunters Point, Asian and Latinos, and other people, and promised the people that live in Hunters Point some work, but they were given, for example, one individual out of a family that's been on West Point over 60 years, he was given 2 days a week but they're continuously watching other people come in and working around the clock. So consequently, the same tactics that we had to use to get the attention of the politicians and the people back in the 60s and 70s, we still have to use right now. So consequently, they set fire not only to the frame, the building frame, but they set fire to the tractors and all the equipment. And so I've come to find out, I've been doing some work in West Oakland related to some seniors who's having problems with a management company, who comes to find out that that same management company is doing some work up on West Point and Little Point. Also, the same management company was doing some work in West Oakland, senior building where the fire to West Oakland, where the West Oakland bar station caught on fire. It's the same people doing the same thing. And I'll be over there today to pick up some information and some documentation to bring to the meeting tonight to show how these same individuals are using the same tactics. And they're getting the same responses. And ABU says, if we can't work, can't nobody work. We held that back in the 60s, and we mean it today, but not just in Hunts Point, throughout the Bay Area. Throughout the Bay Area, because they're using the same tactics to divide and conquer. Racism and divisionism is alive and well in San Francisco right now. And so, consequently, they're getting the same thing that they got then, they're getting it now. They're using the same tactics to be fighting the same way. But our politicians throughout the Bay Area, especially San Francisco, are not upholding their campaign promises. But they've been after Hunters Point since the 50s because of the view. From my mother's house on Middle Point, we used to stand in our kitchen window and see the Golden Gate Bridge, the Bay Bridge, and sometimes the San Mateo Bridge at the same time on the same day. And it's an excellent view. And so they've been trying to get that for years by any means necessary. And so some of the people that live in Hunters Point, West Point, Middle Point specifically, plan on defending that view by any means necessary. And it's come to pass now. They're seeing. And they're going to get the same result that they got then. If that's the only thing that they can respond to, that they adhere to, then that's what they're going to get.
Right. I was wondering, we have about 12 minutes, 15 minutes left, and I was wondering how this historic meeting and conversation shaped each of your lives and the direction that they took, because I believe most of you have had, you know, significant careers that have certainly changed the communities where you worked in a positive way. And I was wondering, and I think, believe a couple of you are actually retired now, and I was wondering if you could talk about the direction your life took, you know, after this conversation. And, and then today is also a day known as Juneteenth, June 19, referencing June 19, 1865, when the enslaved Africans in Texas found out that they were free. So,
yes.
Anyway. So.
Okay, well, I'd like to interject into that.
Sure.
Okay, the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 by Lincoln was to keep the United States united, because places like Virginia, they wanted slaves, West Virginia didn't, and it goes on and on. But anyway, Lincoln had slaves himself, and it was all about economics, which it is right now. Economics goes all the way down from the whole United States, the world, to Bayview Hunters Point. It's all economics. And so as I became educated, because when I was young, when they talked about, and Oscar interjected really, really well on this point about black history, how they're removing the classes. In fact, there was only a small part of history. It seemed like it was in a foreign country. with the way they used to talk about it in class. Okay, so anyway, I went out and I did some studying and I found some paintings and Linda Lovelace O'Neill, who's the director over at Berkeley Art Department, she had a painting called Lincoln, called Running, Freed More Slaves Than Lincoln Ever Did. Running, Freed More Slaves Than Lincoln Ever Did. And so I bought this painting because it's very significant and it really comes down to what's going on. Also, my other friend interjected about the divide and conquer. It's the crab in the bucket syndrome. They'll throw peanuts to some people, and as you rise out the bucket, those people will pull you right back down into the bucket. So that's exactly what's going on out there, Davion's point. Now, there are some people who are getting a little bit of it, and then they're not getting given back to the community. They're coming to our community, and they're doing things there that they was doing 50 years ago that I saw. And so now they're even coming out with a tennis shoe with shackles and chains on the tennis shoes, bright colors. They're going to sell for $300. What craziness is this? I mean, shackles and chains on tennis shoes. I mean, everything to keep you down, to keep you in the same place. And so getting back to the Emancipation Proclamation, and I'm going to sum it up. It was all about economics, and they wanted to keep the nation together because they could feed the slaves salt and things, and they was supposedly good out there in the hot sun. It's all about economics, which it is today. It's all the same thing. Okay, I'm finished.
Yeah. Before we go on to the next question, how did this affect your the direction of your life? You know, this meeting, which then and now, it's, you know, similar issues are still unresolved.
Well, Oscar James, I want to interject on something because it changed my life to commit myself. Number one, I got out of violence. Doing the things I was doing at that time, and it changed my life to become an activist in my community. I joined a group called Joint Housing, which overseen all the development of the new housing in the Baby Hunters Point on top of that hill, $40 million that Ms. Westbrook, Ms. Webb, and Ms. Washington, and all of them had went back to Washington, D.C., and Julia Comer went back to D.C. and brought $40 million back where Mayor Joseph Alioto could not bring that money back. And that redid all the housing projects, the old wartime housing projects. And being a young person at that time, I was 18, and I was the youngest person sitting on the joint housing, and we made sure that everyone in the community who was in the old wartime projects got a $4,500 relocation, also a certificate of preference to move back into the community once they built it. And that certificate also went to any place that redevelopment developed throughout the whole city and county of San Francisco. But the problem that we've had on that, I mean, and even then, we had at that time we had 50% of our peoples in the community working on those houses up there. We've also fought and got the memorandum of understanding, which got all of the unions to sign to have programs to train people in our community back then. All those people are retired now. I've also retired from the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency, which I watchdog for the last 40 years while working for them to make sure they kept people in our community employed. Now, our new governor came in, and he wiped out the Redevelopment Agency that developed all of this city, the YBC, the Moscone Center, and all of that. But now we don't have that to complete our projects in the Bayview Hunters Point, such as Alice Griffin, the old Double Rock, or the Hunters Point Shipyard. 1973, the shipyard closed. Today, we have no development in the shipyard, but they develop all of Mission Bay with the UC Hospital. They develop all of downtown, but our community has not been developed. And when they start working out here to make sure we do not live here, they don't give our people any jobs no more. They diluted our memorandum of understanding, you know, and they're bringing all these other peoples in, and everything we fought for with the memorandum of understanding, with the guaranteed college education, with us getting the $3.5 million for scholarships through the Lennar Corporation, and they're moving our peoples out to Oakland, to Antioch, to all these other places that has low rent to get them out, and all these other races coming out to community, and they're going to benefit from the things that we've formed, such as memorandum of understanding guaranteeing jobs and the scholarships. You know, so they get us on two sides. They don't educate our young peoples, so they don't qualify to go to college. They don't educate our young peoples to get into these unions now, because the unions, when we were going into the unions, you didn't have to have a high school diploma. Now you have to have a high school diploma. You have to be drug-free. You know, you have to even get training, even in the labor's union, which you didn't have to have no qualifications. You could have the longest record in the world and still be hired and work to take care of your family. They come up with all these mechanisms not to have black peoples working, not to educate black peoples. The other day we went down and fought the Board of Education. They brought a principal from AP Giannetti, who was messing up black folks over in the Sunset District, brought her into our school, Malcolm X Academy School, in our community, the only junior high school we have. Brought her in. She's sitting on top of our young girls in the school, and I don't have anything against homosexuals or anything like that, but she's a homosexual. And she sat on top of this student to chastise her in the schools. We're trying to get her removed. We're fighting the Board of Education right now. These are the things that we have to stop our people from going to school. When James Baldwin came and talked about the president having a black president, yes, we have a black president now. He's doing a good job. The Republican Party is fighting him as hard as he can fight him. But we are not getting the things in our community that he's talking about for everyone. The black peoples are still missing out. We still are lacking the opportunities. And it's not because we're not in our communities fighting for those things. It's because the system is not educating our kids. You know,
okay,
we need more black parents that go into the school system. We need more black people to come to these meetings, like the workshop we're going to have tonight, talking about James Baldwin program. Look and see how many people our people's going to be there. Those are the things we need to go out and support and get behind to make sure. You know, I'm retired, but my commitment now is to make sure these young peoples benefit like we benefit from what the older people have done. Percy Pigmy, Oliver Lester, they came back to the community and made sure we benefited. It's time for us to come back to this community and let our young people benefit and become economically stable. We need to have more business owned in this community by black folks. We need to have the history of what our foreparents did in this community, because the young people do not know. Only time they know is when we go back into the community and tell them what our foremothers and forefathers have done in this community to make it a success like it is, so they can have hopes and dreams. They have no hopes and dreams. They're walking around killing each other because they don't know the history of them, their own selves. Now, I'll let someone else go on talking. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. You have your heart in it, and I love you for that. What happened and what helped me was that, like he said, they're role models. My father-in-law was one of my role models, Clarence Leonard.
Yes,
he
was.
And I had other role models. And I'm telling you, my wife was an influence on me, Dolores Bell. And
Reverend Bell.
After that meeting with Dolores Leonard Bell, and after that meeting with Mr. Baldwin, I decided that I was going to turn my life around, because it was kind of rough up there. We all had firearms and different things. I'm going to lay it out there like it was. It was rough.
Right.
But thanks to these role models and thanks to that film, I think that it really helped a lot of us. And I'm really proud of the people who are still working there in Hunters Point. And that's the reason why this film is so significant, because it will expose some of the younger people and show them that there is another way to go through education, through being aware of your surroundings, being aware and conscientious of people. And just remember, the same thing happening then is happening now, and we need to all band together to put a stop to this.
Mm-hmm. Right. I want the audience to know that we've been speaking to Mr. Famous, Jackie Dale, Mr. Oscar James, and Mr. James Lockett about this experience they had about 50 years ago in Bayview Hunters Point, where they were able to meet and have a conversation with the wonderful author and activist and scholar James Baldwin. And tonight at the Lucky Shore Gallery, which is located at 1007 Market Street in San Francisco, the free screening, which begins at 7:30. Caroline Dens has a film entitled James Baldwin in San Francisco, Hunters Point, Then and Now, and it's based on the rarely seen 1964 film Take This Hammer, which is also going to be screened. So that's going to be really wonderful, and definitely everyone needs to grab some young person and take them with them to see this film tonight. Are you all going to be able to make it to the screening?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I'm going to try to make it. And I'm just hoping that through this film that they'll see that violence is not the way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be more educated and just try to help out in your community.
Yes.
Well, thank you both. Mr. Lockett has to go back to his meeting. But thank you both for joining us to talk about this great film, and really looking forward to meeting you this evening at the Lucky Shore Gallery screening in San Francisco.
Oh, you're quite welcome, and thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
All right. Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello?
Yeah, Wanda.
Oh, uh-huh.
Hello?
Yeah,
so anyway, I'll probably give you another call today because I'm going over there after I get out of these meetings, and I'm going over there
to... We're still on the air, Mr. Lockett.
Oh, okay, okay. I'll call you later.
Okay, all right. Take care. Look forward to seeing you this evening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, we are going to be joined by filmmaker Catherine Fairfax Wright and Malaika Zuhali Borough and Long John to talk about a film that's screening as a part of the Frame Line 36, San Francisco's lesbian, gay, transgender film festival. And this particular film, called Mikuchu, is really magnificent. I wasn't able to watch it all, but what I was able to see was really, really remarkable. And the synopsis reads, in Uganda, a new bill threatens to make homosexuality punishable by death. David Kato, Uganda's first openly gay man, and his fellow activists work against the clock to defeat the legislation while combating vicious persecution in their daily lives. But no one is prepared for the brutal murder that shakes their movement to its core and sends shockwaves around the world. In an unmarked office at the end of a dirt track, veteran activist David Kato labels to repel Uganda's homophobic laws and liberate his fellow lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender men and women, or Kuchus. But David's formidable task just became much more difficult, and because of this new anti-homosexuality bill that I mentioned. And what the bill proposes is death for HIV-positive gay men in prison for anyone who fails to turn in a known homosexual. Inspired by American evangelists who have christened Uganda ground zero in their war on the homosexual agenda, the bill awaits debate in Uganda's parliament. Meanwhile, local newspapers have begun outing Kuchus with vicious fervor under the headlines such as Homo Terror, We Name and Shame Top Gays, and Take in the City. And that was really amazing. They actually published the photographs and names of people who were gay, and then people were trying to, well, they were targets of violence, brutal violence. David Uganda's first openly gay man is one of the few who dared to publicly protest state-sanctioned homophobia. Working with the idiosyncratic clan of fellow activists, David signed fights Uganda's government and tabloids in the courts, on television, and at the United Nations. Because, he insists, if we keep on hiding, they will say we're not here. for 1 year to filming, called Mikuchu, and just 3 weeks after the landmark legal victory on January 26, 2011, the unthinkable happened. David is brutally murdered in his home. His death sends south waves around the world and leaves Kampala Kuchu traumatized and seeking answers for a way forward. With unprecedented access, Call Me Kuchu depicts the last year in the life of a courageous, quick-witted, and steadfast man whose wisdom and achievements were not fully recognized until after his death. While heartbreaking, the documentary traces a narrative that takes the viewer beyond the chronicle of victimization depicted in international news media. It tells the nuanced story of David and Kampala's Kuchu as they work to change their fate and that of other Kuchus across Africa. A story told in his words, David Kato's final testimony lives on in this film while his work is continued by the fellow activists he left behind. And our guests are not with me yet. Oh, there they are. Perfect timing. Good morning. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Oh, yeah. I just finished reading the synopsis.
Yeah, I heard. So I was listening.
So perfect, perfect timing. So are all of you all together?
I'm not, but I believe Long John's... Oh, I'm not sure where Long John's is. Malika says he's almost on, but we can continue with me. Malika's unable to join us, but I am here and happy to speak to you.
Okay, sure. So which one of the directors?
I'm Catherine Fairfax.
Oh, Catherine. Oh, okay, super. And so Malika is joining. I think this might be her right here.
Hi.
Probably Long
John. Yeah, this is Malika.
Oh, Malika. Oh, super. And
you weren't joining.
Is Long John going to join us as well?
Long John's actually caught in traffic right now. He's on his way, so we're hoping he might be able to join us shortly.
Okay, sure. Well, before I read your bio, which is really impressive, it seems like both of you all met at the Film Independent Documentary Lab and the Gary Scott Documentary Development Grant. Is that where you all met each other? Because you both are alumnus of that particular
No, we actually got that with the film.
Oh, okay, super. So how did you all come to Uganda to make this story, and how did you come to work together as filmmakers?
Go ahead. I'm confused, Malika. I thought you weren't calling it. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just... we basically came to the story because we'd heard about this case of an activist called Victor Mukasa, a transgender LGBT activist who sued the Ugandan Attorney General in 2008 and won his case. His home had been raided by the Ugandan police, and he decided he wasn't going to let it pass, so he took the Ugandan Attorney General to court for police harassment and won his case. And we were kind of amazed there about this idea that the judiciary was independent enough to be able to acknowledge that LGBT people had these basic constitutional rights, even as there were these terrible sodomy laws on the books that basically said that any known homosexual, anyone caught in the act of homosexuality could be put in prison.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So was this film like anything either of you had ever made before?
We had worked in the region in various capacities, both in film and through journalism and things like that. But this was, the first project was kind of being at the helm for a feature-length film.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So I'll read your bios, and then we'll talk more about this journey, because you filmed for over a year before your protagonist
was killed brutally. That must have been really horrific and traumatizing for you as directors. Yes, you continued on and you finished the film. So I want you to talk about that. Let me let our audience know a little bit about your background. Catherine Fairfax Wright, director, DP and editor. What does the DP stand for?
Director of Photography.
Oh, okay, thank you. Yeah, I read that you were a great photographer as well. And Catherine graduated from Columbia University with a double major in film studies and anthropology. She produced Gabby on the Roof in July, which premiered at FinQuest in 2010, and won Best Narrative Feature and Best Actress at the Brooklyn Film Festival. Weaned on the School of Verite Filmmakers, Wright has worked closely with Vince Georgian Perlmutt, Nelson Walker III, and Felipe Barbosa. She associate produced Perlmutt and Walker's award-winning documentary, Lumo, which aired on POV and won the 2007 Student Academy Award, as well as Perlmutt's Les Vulnerables, the closing short at the New York Film Festival 2007. Wright has worked in a producing role on several other films, and she is an award-winning photographer. I wanted you to tell us, what is the Lumo? What is that film about?
Lumo,
what was that
story?
I couldn't hear that question, sorry.
What was Lumo about?
Lumo, what is Lumo about? You're breaking up.
Lumo tells the story of a rape survivor in the Democratic Republic of Congo and her recovery process after getting surgery to repair her fistula. So it's a character portrait of, you know, the war in the DRC and its implications on the woman.
Okay. Wow. How do you pronounce your name? I want to say Malaika, but that's not how you say it, right?
Yeah, it's Malaika, yeah.
Malaika, thank you. Malaika's work as a print and video journalist has been published in the Financial Times and at CNN.com. She has reported with CNN.com from India, Uganda, China, and the United States on politics, technology, and LGBT rights. She is a graduate of Cambridge University and holds an MA in International Affairs from the Paris Institute of Political Studies. She is also a Chaz and Roger Ebert Directing Fellow, and as we already mentioned, an alumnus, both of them, of the Film Independent Documentary Lab and Garrett Scott Documentary Development Grant at Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, which you both said helps you with this particular film.
Yeah,
I was wondering if you could, pardon me, say this again?
I was just saying, yeah, they were a great help.
Mm-hmm. Right. So talk a little bit about this film and the protagonist. Tell us about him and tell us about these other men and women that you met in a country that is 95%, I believe was one of the statistics early in the film, that that is against homosexuality and, I mean, vehemently opposed to homosexuality. And I wondered why... you know, why David would want to return, because he talks about how, I believe, was he in Southern Africa or South Africa, where he was able to be in a community where it was okay to be who he was, and he lived outside of the country, I believe, for 5 or 6 years or something, and then he went back.
Yeah, I mean, that just kind of indicates what a remarkable guy he was. I mean, it wasn't enough for just him to experience that freedom on an individual scale, but once he had a sense of that and what life could be like for them and how much, you know, support they could get from each other and their community and churches and, you know, be accepted by the general populace, he really felt a very strong need to bring that to, you know, his brethren back home in Uganda. And I think kind of he never really expressed any doubt about that for us. I mean, he never... He was, you know, would say to us frequently that he would be the last to leave the country, that he had, you know, even, you know, that to some extent something like asylum might seem appealing, he actually had no desire to flee. His intentions really lay with helping out everyone that was in need and allowing everyone to benefit from policy changes and such, not just fleeing from the problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. So talk about sort of how you went about making this wonderful film, and talk about the other subjects that you met, the women that you met, the, you know, Long Johns, who is a counselor. The film opens with a renewal of vows. I think that's really, really nice. Talk about the community that you met there, and what the loss of such a key figure in this particular movement has meant to those who were left behind.
Yeah, the film opens up with an anniversary party of a gay couple in Uganda, and it was really important to us to work towards capturing moments like that. You know, it took some time to get, you know, to allow the community to acclimate to us and gain, you know, our trust and start, you know, realizing that this was a legitimate project that was, you know, had their best intention, you know, in mind, and we didn't seek to turn their work back against them or anything. We just wanted to reveal the realities of their daily existence. So moments like that were incredibly important for us to be able to capture, because we just, you know, thought that maybe the best way to capture these people and tell their story to the world in order to convince people of the legitimacy of their human rights was to show them, you know, as humanistically as possible and capture them as people and friends and sisters and mothers and fathers, just like everyone else on the planet. So capturing the community in moments like that was really important to us. And then, you know, in the wake of David's death, it was similarly important in that, you know, while we had just kind of logistically, we had to figure out a way to carry on with filming and complete the film with, you know, in the absence of our protagonist. And, you know, the best way to do that was to kind of carry on with the other subjects that we had already been following and, you know, see how they picked up where he left off and, you know, kind of conflicting tensions between a very real threat, you know, of the ultimate threat kind of death already having, you know, been realized, and that, you know, indicating maybe that they should take a few steps back or fly under the radar a little bit, but then at the same time wanting to be, you know, being all the more galvanized in the wake of his death and wanting to fight even harder for their rights to be recognized. You know, so those were also really important moments for us to be able to share with the world.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So talk about some of these subjects. Naomi, she mentions a lot about the whole idea of activism. Even when she was outed in The Guardian, is that what the name of the, you know, that
the Rolling newspaper? Stone.
Yeah, The Rolling Stone. What a name, huh?
Mm-hmm.
yeah. And she still didn't allow that exposure to keep her from being, you know, a person that was going to demand her rights as a citizen in that society. And then, you know, Stosh, you know.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, talk about your characters, the bishop, et cetera.
Yeah, well, actually all of our characters, I was just going through them in my head, and I think all of our you know, main protagonists have been outed by that one newspaper, The Rolling Stone, as well as various other newspapers and tabloids. Even Bishop Sununjo, who actually isn't even a member of the LGBT community, he just refuses to stop supporting them and counseling them. And he's been written up many times in those vicious tabloids. But yeah, we were really fortunate to find an incredibly charismatic, intelligent, you know, fun-loving but hard-working community when we got to Kampala, and we're very excited to be able to spend so much time with them, sharing, you know, learning their stories and then sharing them. Naomi is one of them. She's a very motherly, kind-hearted, very good friend of David, and also an activist. She kind of plays the role of the person who brings everyone together. You know, she's the one going to David's house, but also going to check on Stosh and throwing a party that Long Jones is the MC of at her house. And, you know, anyways, all the characters kind of funnel through her. And Long Jones is another amazing guy that we got to spend a lot of time with. He'll actually be at our screenings in the U.S. over the next couple of weeks with us. And he, you know, when we first met him, was kind of more of a hesitant activist. He was only just coming to the fore of the activist movement. And, you know, over the course of filming, really ended up stepping up to the plate, especially in the wake of David's death, and really dedicating his life to it, despite the obvious increased security threats and stuff that he would suffer on account of that. And then similarly, Bishop Sinyonjo has just been kind of relentless in his support of the LGBT community, despite being you know, kicked out and ostracized from the Anglican Church of Uganda, in which he had been a bishop for many, many decades. And losing his pension, and, you know, certainly having his family go through a lot of trouble and things like that. He just has kind of decided to go forward with his support for the LGBT community and never look back, and it's pretty remarkable to witness.
His stance as a supporter of Uganda's LGBT community is really remarkable when one thinks about, because you give a really good background of where this homophobia and anti-gay is coming from.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that
a little bit.
Long Jones is here.
Oh, hi, Long Jones.
Oh. Oh, super. Oh, great. Long Jones, wonderful. Why don't you talk about that? And you're
not sure if you heard the question.
Oh, okay.
Long Jones, you were asking about the kind of where all this recent vitriol against the LGBT community comes from, the roots of it and the evangelical presence in Uganda. Is that what you were asking about?
This is Long Jones. Thank you very much. The hatred that was created mostly was influenced by the American evangelicals, the fundamentalists, who actually came in early 2009 and had a conference with parents and other leaders in the society, and were telling them that homosexuality can be cured, that it is there's a clique of persons in the Western world who have the interest of spreading homosexuality worldwide. And this really caused a very big impact, and ever since then, everything never remained the same in the lives of homosexuals in Uganda. So it's within that time that the evangelicals in Uganda started organizing themselves, and it was for the first time that the Muslims and the Christians in Uganda united for the agenda to push forward the anti-homosexual bill, which was introduced in
2009. Wow. Yeah. So what's going on in Uganda presently, and how is what's happening in Uganda indicative of, is it isolated, or is it indicative of the region, East African region?
In Uganda, it's so much more. Actually, Uganda is very, very hostile compared to other parts in the region. Kenya is not so hostile compared to the situation in Uganda. Only that, I would really say that in the coast of Kenya, around Mombasa, it's really, really bad there also, because even the dress code matters, even just with the heterosexual people, a lady putting on a topless or a more exposing blouse or dress, revealing more of her body, is causes a lot of tension, and you could even be leached, actually. We also know that one of the Kenya Institute of Research was at one time attacked by the people because they said it was giving health services to the gay community there. So when you look, go back to Kigali, the Rwandan government came out so clearly and said that what people do behind their, what people do in their privacy is not the concern of the government. Despite all these messages coming up, the Uganda government is not heeding, they are not looking into the challenges that they are the only ones who are trying on to hold to laws that were established so many years back, and despite even the colonialists who colonized us have moved on, but then they are holding on to this draconian kind of laws. So it is so unfortunate for us that we are still in such a situation. But what I must also put forward is that the situation is not really good, because even just as I speak, yesterday there was another workshop that was threatened by the Minister of Integrity, Reverend Lokodo. It was an organizing of Eastern Horn, which is a human rights defenders project, and it was all about empowering and giving skills and capacity building for the human rights activists. So this workshop was closed, and this now is the second workshop that is closed by the same minister in relationship to LGBT work. So it totally gives a very different picture of whether we have hope that we shall be able to assemble. And with so many bills that are pending in the Ugandan parliament, we have the bill of public order management bill, which was proposed. And once such a bill passes, it even makes things more difficult for us to operate, because you cannot hold a gathering without informing the police. You cannot hold a gathering once you're more than, it proposes either more than five people, you must inform the police, whether at your house or anywhere. So this will be very difficult for people to hold gatherings and maybe plan or strategize or even carry out the LGBT work that is already moving on. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I was just thinking when you were speaking about the Judeo-Christian Islamic perspective that is fueling this, campaign, which is a real mild word, but against the LGBT community. And I was wondering, as a young person, growing up in Uganda, if from an indigenous spiritual perspective, was there acceptance of, people's different sexual orientations? And is this Western religion concept, is this more something coming from the outside as opposed to what was, another way of looking at the whole thing? I was wondering, is there another spiritual tradition that supports the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community and its right to exist?
Basically, no church has openly come out to say that they support this, but I could know a few. Maybe for the sake of security reasons, I may not really have to point out which particular churches, but I could identify a few churches. They do not encourage, but they do not condemn or preach or criticize the homosexuals. Because what happens in most of these other churches, when you go there, each Sunday, not someone goes by without them talking or preaching about homosexuality. So these other churches have just been silent. And right now we know that there is a group of pastors that have sued or are having a court battle with one other pastor in Uganda, claiming that he's been sexually involved with young boys. The court ruled in favor of the accused, but again, the complainants said they were not satisfied by the court's ruling, claiming that this other pastor bribed the judge with a car and lots of money. So the four pastors are taking back or have appealed to the High Court for the case to be brought back on table. And the High Court has actually proved and accepted that this case should be heard again. So it gives you an impression of the battle that is going on, not only to the general community of the LGBT, but even among churches that could be gay-friendly. The battle is even among the leaders themselves. The population of the youth are a bit open-minded. Some really don't very much criticize or point fingers. They think that is the right of people should have their right the way they are. But it also depends from which background you're coming on. There are, most families have very strong religious backgrounds, and I think they are the majority. And you may even find that youths at that age still may not really accept to deal with the acceptance that truly homosexuals are people who are born that way and have a right to live the way they should live, yeah, in society.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, it was really amazing, the aspect of the film that looked at privacy and how the government supported, you know, spying and setting people up, and how most of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, you know, because the community, the Hutu community, were passing. You know, they were, you know, trying to be mainstream so that they wouldn't bring unnecessary hostile attention to themselves because of this environment. And I was wondering, if the directors, if you could talk about how the film has been received there. Have you had a screening?
About the bill?
In Uganda. Yeah, have you screened a film in Uganda? Are you planning on screening the film in Uganda?
Yeah, I mean, we would certainly like to. I think it's more a matter of figuring out the best way to do that, you know, both for the security of everyone who might be in attendance, but also in terms of not ruining our chances of anyone who might be slightly more on the fence seeing it, and, you know, without prior judgment, you know, without already knowing that it was, some tool of the Kuchu community, that they, you know, were screening left and right, or that some riot had started because of, or something like that. You know, we would love to be able to kind of have it be shown, you know, kind of behind closed doors,
in
a more relaxed private setting as much as possible before it's kind of stigmatized as just another recruitment tool or whatever they're going to categorize it as.
Yeah,
I think the gay community is very anxious. Yes, they are very many were questioning me and are eager to, they're interested in seeing the documentary themselves. But like the director of the movie, the documentary said, it all depends on what environment is taking place at that time, because we don't know what is going to happen between now and the time when they plan, because they do not even have a time plan when they think they will be or they should be in Uganda to show this. So with this all upcoming, or like the unfolding circumstances that are happening, workshops being closed and all these kind of things, the only safe place where you thought, because if they go to an extent of closing up a workshop that is organized by a human rights body or organization, I mean, that shows you that the government is really determined to crack down and totally do away with encouraging or what they usually call the promotion and recruitment of young children into homosexuality. So it depends on what will be happening at that time, but the community is very eager and they are very impressed by the work done, and they are looking forward to seeing this movie, the documentary.
Wow. Yeah, it seems like a really hostile environment, and I wonder, Long John, why would you want to stay there? Why anyone, if they could leave, why would you go live somewhere that you could be a lot freer and a lot safer and a lot happier? Why do you stay?
My moving out from Uganda will mean losing the struggle or the focus or the whole spirit of activism. Being on ground is the only way we can fight this battle, because if every leader who comes up moves away, then that means our struggle or achievements will not come to pass, because that will be a sign of weakness that, yes, I rose up, we did a struggle, things did not work out, I had to move on. So the next person also will get to a certain level and move on. And if we all keep moving on, so how long shall we have to move on to? So we need to be there on the ground, strategize, plan, bring to the reality, tell the world we are here, tell our fellow Ugandans we are here. Slowly, they will begin supporting us, accepting the fact, because at the end of the day, we've tested the courts, we've tested the law, and we've won cases in court, which is quite a symbol of progress that the community gets to realize. Today we are dialoguing and trying to continue identifying various partners we can work with, especially in the security, in the area of security. Once the police get to understand that, yes, as a gay man, you have a right to live your life the way you should be, that will be another step forward, because we are now moving towards seeing how to influence the decriminalization of the penal code, which does not acknowledge any sexual act between two consenting adults of the same sex. So these are the challenges we have, because I've seen many people, or I've seen my fellow activists who were very firm on ground, and they've moved out, they've seeked asylum elsewhere, and they don't even remember anything. They do not even enforce anything back home. So they move on, and because the environment they begin to experience is more acceptable and friendly to them, they think, oh, I survived all that trouble, I survived all the... So they tend to forget that where they came from, there's still more need to fight on. So to me, as Long Johns, I would want to be there on ground to the last minute. So I don't really think, or even I don't know if I have plans or thinking of seeking asylum anywhere.
Right. Yeah, I'm reminded of the civil rights movement and other movements in this country, America, and the brave men, women, and children that put their bodies on the line so that all of us would have access to the same, you know, democratic rights that all citizens and residents are supposed to have. So, yeah, really, really admirable what you're doing. And I was wondering, Catherine and Malika, if you could give our audience some information about how they can be in touch with you. You've got a screening tonight as a part of Frame Line 36 at the Castro Theater, 7 p.m. You're going to be there along with Long John, who is in town. So that's exciting.
Yes, and the bishop will also be with us. So that's exciting.
Super.
And then, so we have Frame Line tonight,
awesome.
And then we're going right to Silver Docks in Silver Springs, Maryland, outside of D.C. We'll be there on the 20th and 22nd. And then we have a screening at Human Rights Watch Film Festival for the closing night on June 28th at 7 p.m. And then we have screenings starting in we have East End Film Festival in London, July 5th, and then Jerusalem Film Festival, Kosovo Documentary Film Festival, and many, many others. And then we're also in the process of planning further community screenings and hopefully a theatrical run and stuff like that. And that information is all available on our website, which is www.callmecuchu, that's K-U-C-H-U.com. Mm-hmm. Sign up for our newsletter or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Both are just Call Me Cuchu. And, yeah, you must get all that information in any of those social media sites.
Right, yeah, and for the San Francisco Bay Area, tonight is the night, June 19th, Juneteenth, at Castro Theater, 7 p.m., and it's going to be really exciting. And you all are really making a world tour. I mean, you've already been, you know, South Africa and other places, and now you're going to the other part of the world. Wow, that's amazing.
Yep, well, that's our intention, as much as we can.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in closing, we have another question for you, Lon Jones, and I wanted to ask you, Catherine and Malika, I keep on mispronouncing your name, but wondering if as directors, how, I mean, all, you know, every time you make a film, every time you have a project, I'm sure that you're changed in some way as an artist and as a person, and I was wondering how meeting David and Lon Jones and Bishop, how do you pronounce his name?
Sinyonjo
and Naomi and Sash and others, and just being, you know, there in this place and, you know, I'm sure not often feeling safe, but wanting to get this story so you can share it with a larger audience and perhaps, you know, help, you know, Lon Jones and his constituents in Uganda realize their vision for their society more quickly than if the film had never been made and the story had never gotten told. So I think so how this changed you and in any kind of tangible way that you could share with us.
Sure. I mean, I think most particularly with this film was just the kind of sudden and unexpected onus that we felt, you know, once David had passed away and that we had essentially documented the last year in his life and had on record all of his, you know, wisdom and knowledge that he had gained over the years and in terms of how to propel this movement forward and how to, you know, convince people in the most, you know, efficient and respectful manner possible that, you know, the LGBT community is worthy of their human rights and that they should be recognized. So, you know, I think we both, Malik and I, felt very privileged to have spent so much time with him and to have been able to document that. And then, you know, once he passed away, it really felt like, wow, we wanted to make the most of this and enable as many people as humanly possible to see it and to fall in love with David's character like we had, and in so doing also, you know, realize all the further why LGBT rights should be recognized globally. So I think just kind of the responsibility.
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh. Uh-oh. I can't hear you anymore, Catherine. Hello? Is anyone there?
Yeah, Lon Jones is here.
Oh, Lon Jones, okay. Well, Lon Jones, the question I wanted to ask you is, what would you like to happen with this film? And if, before you do that, if you could tell us the term Cuchu, what does it mean? And how did it come to represent the community that you're a part of?
Actually, it was a couple of years back. I could maybe put it, it's over 5 years actually, when we were having a drink at one of the bars, and we were there with a couple of other gay friends. And we were like, because everyone knew the word homosexual, everyone knew the word gay. And we said, actually, it was one of the clergies who happens to be also gay who came up with the idea and said, what do you guys think about getting a word that would that we can identify ourselves with? And that's the time, because Kuchu is not a word, it's not a Luganda word. It's not any word anywhere. So it just came up, and this one was like, how about Kuchu? And we all agreed, and we started calling ourselves Kuchu. So basically, Kuchu is what we call ourselves. I call myself Kuchu, and I don't feel offended someone calling me Kuchu or calling another person Kuchu. And from those, that term Kuchu, we got other terms which would refer to either a top or bottom, still using the same word, the same word Kuchu. And so it is a word that is very much it's widespread in the gay community, and I'm quite impressed now East Africa, most people in East Africa also tend to use it. The gay community in East Africa are also using it among themselves. If you ask them, they will tell you, yes, so that is Kuchu. And also now it has kind of gone international, that some human rights activists and other people are getting to realize that the word Kuchu is an identity that we in Uganda used for to identify ourselves. Yeah.
Okay, got a little echo in there, and Catherine is back with us. And so in closing, Long Jones, what is your hope for the film?
Well, okay, looking at the film itself, actually, I was impressed, and it reminded me of so many things back, because it was quite challenging. I mean, the two people, Malika and Katie, were very brave. I mean, at that time, you know, the environment in Uganda with the bill being very hot and everyone running up and down, the churches coming up, the Muslim fraternity coming up, calling, kill them, or we shall kill them if the government does not pass the bill, we shall do that if this does not happen. So actually our worry today is more about the society, the general society. We may not be, to me I'm not so worried about the government, because the laws are there, yes, but for you to really become a victim of the law, they must really catch you in the act and prove even beyond just action. So, but what really bothers me is the society around us, because those are the people who can easily attack you or insult you and or carry out mob justice on you. So that is it. But the movie depicts the in-depth and the reality of what is on ground without additions or minus or, you know, fine-tuning anything. The words, the speaking, everything that was said came out from the bottom of people's heart. And I noticed that even among my very own activists, people have stories that they have held to themselves and decided either to hold and hold because they cannot even share it anywhere. There are certain things my friend Tosh spoke on in the documentary, and I was also shocked because I thought I knew Tosh. We had shared a lot. We speak to each other. She comes to me. We talk so much. We plan so much. But there are certain things that perhaps she could have never shared with me, and I only got to know when I was watching the movie. And each time I see these tears fill my eyes, and I feel sorry. For David's case, those were one of the greatest and lively moments I saw in his life. And each time I remember the words he was saying, if I die, I should be, I don't want to be buried here, I want to be buried in a gay village. I mean, these were all dreams, and I even think, was he predicting that perhaps sooner or later he may not be, he may not live longer. But in the end, I'm so impressed that Katie and Malika's work is one of the greatest documentations for the Ugandan LGBTI movement. Very many people have taken our story and have gone. But for them, they've been very sincere, honest, and they've really kept in touch. Since 2010, when they first came to Uganda, these two people have always been in touch with each and every person involved in regards to the situation in Uganda. They've been very concerned. They've always made phone calls. They've always sent emails. And to me, I think they I don't know the best words, but I really very, very much appreciate. I really, very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us today to talk about this wonderful film, Call Me Coochie, and good luck on the world tour with your stops this evening in San Francisco and some other stops in this country before you make your international debut again.
thank you very much.
Yeah, and right, yeah. Unfortunately, I have another film to go see same time.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah, it would have been really lovely to meet you and Long Jones and the Bishop and your co-director, Malika. Oh, I got it right this time. Cool. Right. Well, definitely stay in touch. Let me know when you have your theatrical debut. We can have you on again to talk about that. I'm looking forward to being able to see it again with a a theater audience. That'd be really nice.
Yeah, okay. We hear. Great. Well, we would love that. Thank you so much for having us.
Sure. And Long Jones, when I'm in East Africa, I'll definitely come by and see you.
Thank you so much.
All right. You take good care.
And thank you very much for the American people for supporting us. Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Yeah.
Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye. You're welcome. So we're going to close with a song by Ben Vereen that's part of the soundtrack for Wicked, and it's called Defying Gravity. And I think this particular song thematically touches on what Long Jones and David and Naomi and Bishop and Yanjo and Sash and others in the gay, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community in Uganda are fighting. They're not letting anyone pull them down. And we think about what's going on in Bayview Hunters Point 50 years ago and today, and how we're looking at James Baldwin's visit and reflecting on that 50 years ago and looking at it now. The men that we had on the show who were teenagers at that time are continuing, to do the work. And so Defying Gravity, I think, is a great, great song that talks about that. Can't let anyone or anything bring us down.
Wicked. I went into the show with Shoshana Dean, and each night I'd hear Shoshana sing this song. I'd like to do it for you now. Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time I trust my instincts, close my eyes, and leave. It's time to try defying gravity. I think I'll try defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. I'm through accepting limits because someone said they're so. Some things I can never change, but till I try, I'll never know. So tired of being afraid of losing love I thought I had lost. Well, if that's love, it comes at much too high a cost. I'd rather buy defying gravity. Defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. Unlimited, my future is unlimited. And I've just had a vision, almost like a prophecy. Oh, I know this may sound crazy, and it's true. The vision is hazy, but I swear, someday I'll be up in the sky, defying gravity. Yes, I can fly. I'll defy gravity, and you can't hold me down. You can't hold me down. To fly. And if I'm flying solo, at least I'm flying free. To those who try to ground me, take a message back from me and tell them I'm defying gravity. Come take my hand. We can defy gravity. At all.